Vern Rigi, and as Ed would say, I have a claim to fame, and that is that I'm married to Jane, and he's married to Chris, my wife over there. I teach law at the University of Washington School of Law. Once upon a time, a long time ago, I was a practicing lawyer. For the last 30 years, I've been teaching, so I'm now what's politely referred to as an academic lawyer. One of the courses that I teach is family law, and that's the reason, of course, that I've been talking to some of you before last week about family law problems. We're going to be discussing this morning the question of the economics in the dissolution of a family, breakup of a family. I get at least a couple more shots at the subjects this week. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, going to talk about whether or not family dissolution ought to be in courts at all, or whether it ought to be outside, handled in some other way. Maybe the time has come when this ought not to be a court-arranged process. And then Friday we're going to be talking about custody problems for children, custody and visitation, and problems that are related to that. There are a great number of dissolutions of marriage in the United States now. Been increasing very rapidly. The Census Bureau says that at least 30%, probably closer to 40% of marriages will end in dissolution. Now, that's like all other statistics, you have to be careful with it. That is not all of the people who marry each other for the first time are going to have that experience. All of the marriages, the difference is being that there are persons who marry 2, 3, 4, 5 times. And the success rate, if you regard success as staying married, varies. First-timers have the best record of all. First-timers will remain married in almost 75% of the cases until one spouse dies. Second-timers, the record is not so good. Third-timers, worse. Fourth-timers, worse. And five-timers, you figure it out for yourself. You've only got so many years to work with. You got to hurry through the process.
If the law lets you
hurry. Yeah, that's right. So the statistic is a bit deceiving. The more distressing statistic, really, is that the dissolution rate of marriage, divorce rate of marriage, discloses only a part of the problem. For every couple that formally dissolves their marriage, there appears to be almost one more couple who separate and who live apart from each other. And so instead of saying 30%, you've got to say about 60% of the marriages do not produce a situation in which the people remain together and living. 60% separate, half of that, or 30% of the total, dissolve their relationship formally, the other half remain separated without technically, formally divorcing. Now, the reason I mention this is that in the process of these separations, among the things that happen is a reallocation of rather massive amounts of property and money, wealth and various kinds. There are other problems. We'll talk about those another day. It has been reported recently by people who gather such statistics that there is now more money or value or property changing hands in separation of married persons than there is in probate. Just think of what that statistic suggests. it's a very, very significant amount of transfer of wealth and obligations occurs in the process of separation or dissolution of marriage. For our purposes this morning, I'd like to break our discussion into three different categories. Now, one is the division of property at the time of a separation or a dissolution. And I'm going to stop saying that now. From now on, I'm just going to say divorce or dissolution of marriage. You can put in the separation for yourself. The formal process, of course, occurs in a dissolution of marriage action. A separation sometimes is formalized in a court action of some sort, sometimes it is not. So I'm going to just refer to it as if they were all divorces or dissolutions. Well, the division of property is one thing. The second category is the provision of what used to be called alimony, still is called alimony in some states. Perhaps more commonly now is referred to something like maintenance or spousal maintenance. It's where one spouse provides income to the person who was his or her spouse before the dissolution, a kind of a continued payment. The third category is support for children. And as we will see a little bit later, children does not necessarily mean minors. It means offspring. So parents may have an obligation to provide child support for a child who is now 25 years of age or 30 years of age in some instances. And of course, if you have a child who is enrolled in college with an annual cost of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 and won't be out of college until age 26, or through med school until age 28, the provision of continued support for that child may become a very major factor to be considered at the time that couples separate or that a family breaks up. Division of property, spousal maintenance or alimony, child support. Those are my three categories that I'd like to put our discussion into this morning. There is no area of law that has moved as rapidly and as dramatically as the field of family law has in the last 20 years. The velocity of change is simply breathtaking. The United States Supreme Court, as I'm sure that all of you sense, whether or not you know statistically or not, handles very few cases, really. It may select out by what's known as a writ of certiorari. That simply means that they certify up or call up on an elective basis. You don't have a right to go to the United States Supreme Court except in a very few cases, very few kinds of cases. The Supreme Court chooses those cases that it's going to handle because they have great precedential value. That is, there are enormously complex or tortured points of law that have to be resolved. And the United States Supreme Court's function in these instances is to call up a case that puts that issue cleanly and then resolve it, and it serves as precedent for the entire United States. The United States Supreme Court has been calling up surprisingly large numbers of domestic relations cases in the last two decades. Because our population has found that both for psychological and emotional and economic reasons and for the care and development of children, that we have need for more and more guidance and development of norms, ground rules, precedents in the area of family law. We are working with an extraordinarily dangerous, difficult area here. 6 out of 10 murders are in the family. There are more policemen killed in breaking up family fights than in anything else the police force does. It's the most dangerous kind of work that police do. Most city police departments have special courses on survival for policemen who are expected to go out and respond to family fights. I personally know lawyers
who have framed the bullet hole in the wall behind their chair, where the angry spouse has taken a shot at them. And I've had the rather thrilling experience of having the half-intoxicated, enraged husband appear at the doorway and grab me by the coat lapels and sort of halfway lift me off the floor and say in Ed Schramm velocity voice, "So you're the son of a bitch that's been shacking up with my wife." And I have to say, no, that's not true.
The voice is mine, but the content is not mine, Brent.
Yes, sir. Reference to volume only, not the content. Now, I mention this because we are dealing here with factors of significance not only to society. $12 million a month is spent by the state of Washington in picking up the pieces from broken families. Very important. We spend more on that than we do in this state on anything else that we do except the public schools and highways. Very, very major factor. Economically significant to society, tremendously economically significant to the people that are involved. The Census Department tells us that currently a family that dissolves its relationship must expect to reduce the standard of living. It used to be 12%, and it's now thought to be 15% decrease in standard of living. You know, you have two houses to support, two tax bills to pay, two utility bills to take care of, and all the rest of those things. So the standard of living inevitably goes down. A question that we will be looking at this morning is who ought to suffer that loss? You know, should it be spread evenly among the members of the family? And the kids get a little less, the mother gets a little less, father gets a little less? Or shall we construct rules that take it out of the hide of just dad or just mom? Or shall we take it all away from the kids and leave mother and dad go on as they were before? What kind of guidelines would you think ought to be developed for these problems? That's what we're talking about. And this is done in the context of, increasingly in the United States, in the context of the dissolution or the termination of the family relationship. Supreme Court of the United States has given us some help in recent years. For example, in March of this year, in a case called Orr against Orr, O-double-R against O-double-R, the Supreme Court made it abundantly clear that the time for making gender sex differences has now passed. In the division of property or the provision of child support or the provision of spousal support, alimony, it's the last time I'm going to say that. Maintenance means alimony, spousal maintenance. In any of those categories, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Any state which says that husbands only have to pay alimony, their statute is unconstitutional. It's got to be gender blind. Wives pay alimony to husbands as well as husbands to wives. Wives support children as well as husbands, and so forth. There are no distinctions to be made on a gender basis.
Was it U.S. Supreme Court?
United States Supreme Court, Orr against Orr, March 1979. United States Supreme Court has also given us some guidance about very difficult questions of reaching across state lines to obtain money and to obtain clear title to property. You know, we are a federation of almost sovereign states. Theoretically, all power does come from the people in our governmental system, despite what we say in our Declaration of Independence. The Ninth Amendment in the Bill of Rights says that all power which is not expressly given, delegated by the people to government, is retained by the people. That's the theory on which we operate, at least, like all other theories, at least theoretically. So, this means that the federal government is a government of delegated and limited powers. States, presumably, are more sovereign than the federal government because they are closer to the source of the power, the consent of those governed, that is, the citizens of a state. Acting upon that principle, many states have insulated their citizens from the claims of citizens of other states. And in practice, what that means in the family dissolution area is that if father is living in the state of Minnesota and earning a job and has enough money to support himself, and mother and the children are living in Iowa and don't have enough money, and they want some of father's money, who is in Minnesota, that Minnesota is going to be kind of reluctant to create a Minnesota welfare case by taking his money and sending it to the residents of Iowa. Let Iowa take care of their paupers, and we will rejoice if we don't have another one in Minnesota. Now, the United States Supreme Court, as I said a moment ago, has in the last couple of years done quite a bit for us in telling us how mama and the kids in Iowa can reach right across the state boundary and grab dad and his pocketbook in Minnesota. Now, Minnesota and Iowa are going to be giving each other the big fisheye in that kind of a situation for obvious reasons. That the taxpayer is going to be very restless about picking up any more bills for these kinds of tragedies than they have to. So one asks ultimately questions like, has the time come when we ought to have family insurance, just like we have Social Security? If we protect people from the ravages of disease and broken arms and job displacement, unemployment, and so forth, has the time now come when we ought to charge people another $10 a month for being married and put it into a fund, and in the event of dissolution, why, there's an insurance fund that we pay out for these social calamities? It sounds so good until you think about the problem of evasion of marriage. Every time you tax people for owning a boat, they're less likely to own a boat. Every time you make marriage more expensive, they are less likely to get married. And if one thinks that marriage is a good idea, then there is a disinclination to impose further obligations upon that state of marriage and make it less attractive, because you simply create more occasion to evade the relationship that legally we would like to have. That is marriage. Forgetting for just a moment the theological and spiritual problems of people living married or unmarried and looking only at the legal problems and social problems, marriage is an extraordinarily useful relationship legally. It has been so always in the civilized worlds. Long before my ancestors, and as far as I can see, all of yours, because you all look like you would have come out of Europe someplace, when my ancestors were still running around in bearskins and beating each other on the head with stone axes, earlier civilizations had firmly established marriage as being the basis for things like gathering tax and deciding who owned what property and who was a citizen of what culture and so forth. Groupings, marriage has been a device that's used in distributing benefits and in distributing burdens. Law must have those categories in order to accomplish these distributive functions, and marriage has been certainly one of the primary ways of doing that. So law likes to have marriages and to have them identified and maintained, among other reasons, for these economic problems and to impose additional burdens upon people getting married is thought not to be very good social policy. I mentioned that to you because perhaps inadvertently in our income tax system we have created a monster with reference to marriage. I mentioned a few days ago, and I'm sure that many of you know, that there are many people in the United States who have tried to evade the extra burden of tax that's imposed upon people who are married By getting a divorce, it's cheap, you know, you can do that for $50. Getting a divorce in December, then they're both separate people. They file their income tax return, save several hundreds of dollars each in income tax payments. Marry again in January. They've spent $50 for legal spinach and saved several hundred dollars in tax, and they will remain happily married until next December when they will divorce again and so forth. Well, the Internal Revenue Service, of course, has not liked that very much, and so they've said, you may be divorced for other purposes, but for income tax purposes, you are not. And they have, in the language that we usually use to describe such things, plugged the loophole. I've often thought that what would we plug if it weren't for loopholes? All loopholes must be plugged, and so that's what they've done. Now I'd like to be more specific about this, and let's start talking about the distribution of property. You remember now, we've got property, we have maintenance payments, alimony, and we have child support. Let's take a case, which I will give you as a hypothetical, although there are dozens, probably hundreds of cases just like this. Husband and wife married just after graduation from high school, very common occurrence now, and wife took a few months, perhaps a year, perhaps 6 months training in secretarial work, and she and husband agreed that he would be educated first and she would support the family, and that after he finished his education, she would get her turn to go to school and to learn whatever she wished to study while he was earning family expenses. So she earns money and supports the family while husband goes through a dental school, for example. He comes out and he establishes a practice, is now making an income, rather good income, has a clientele built up, and is able to live the kind of life that he's always wanted to live. And one day he looks at his wife and says, you know, why should I, a prospering dentist, be married to a dowdy creature who doesn't even have a college education? And files for divorce. There are hundreds of such cases. Not just dentists. Even a lawyer might do that occasionally. They have not accumulated any property. That means they don't have much physical property yet. There's 2 years out in practice, they are still renting, and they don't have much in the way of a bank account yet. But he's got a good practice, he's got a good future, he's got a good clientele in the future. Understand? Is that property which can be divided by a court at the time of the dissolution of the marriage? Or can we do anything? Do you want to do anything with reference to this woman? You understand the facts of the case. What do you think we ought to do at this point? They unfortunately have been unable to agree. Maybe we shouldn't let them decide it by agreement anyway. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But suppose they have not agreed, and they're before you as a judge. What do you propose to do about that?
I'd first of all like to tell that fellow what he is. He's a schlemiel.
A schlemiel. We defined that the other day as being a person who, having killed his father and mother, pleads for mercy on the basis that he's an orphan. Not a very respectable type, of course. All right, we've told him, sir, you are schlemiel. And he says, well, that's all right, but if so, I need assets because not everyone likes a schlemiel and I'll have to pay my own way. What are you going to do economically?
Very difficult to pass property in the future because he could do all kinds of things about not wanting to earn it. He could get all kinds of other loopholes and tax dodges to stick it into.
Yeah.
that, so it's,
if you,
it's difficult.
If you put him into economic slavery for the next 20 years, there's a massive disincentive for him to work very hard. Certainly a vital factor, as a matter of fact. There are thousands of acres of land in the United States today that are not being farmed because some ex-spouse is going to take 60% of all the income or something. There are lots of cheese factories that don't operate very well because some former spouse has a claim on a portion of the income and so forth. All right.
Well, I think at least she deserves some of his income until she can be economically secure, either going back to school. There's some debt there to be repaid for those years of secretarial work.
Would you suggest that we order the husband to pay an amount of money every month, $500 or $1,000 or something, depending on what his income is?
I guess I would. I find it very interesting that the Supreme Court is so progressive about the equality of gender in the alimony situation when our society has not been flexible enough to make it possible for women to be able to pay alimony. They aren't quite as progressive when it comes to other situations.
Women holding the same jobs as men seldom are paid the same salary, even in our society. There are some areas that are closely enough controlled by law so that that's true, but we all know that the earning ability of a woman in today's society is rather markedly less than a male's. Fascinating bit of information, and certainly true. Do you people agree that we should, in this instance, I know you don't have very many facts to work on, but on the facts that you do have, do you agree that we ought to order the husband to pay a number of dollars a month, and we'll let that be determined by his income or something? We'll make a decision about that. We'll get some guidance on how many dollars later process. But do you agree with the notion that this husband should pay this woman a monthly amount for a time? Any disagreement? Do you think that that ought to be for a fixed time, some number of years, or do you think that the time ought to be determined by some eventual factor? I noticed that your suggestion was until she is able to support herself.
Some kind of economic security.
Until she has in some way.
Until she's graduated from dental school.
Yeah, she graduates from dental school. You want to say anything about disincentives at this point? You know, if she's going to have a guaranteed monthly income until she graduates from dental school, she may have more graduate degrees than anybody in dental school has ever packed up before. Why get out and pull teeth when I can sit here and read books?
I know.
It's not unknown for people to settle down into something that's comfortable. And, you know, you got a guaranteed income. The guy's out there earning money. Why should I kill the goose that lays the golden egg? You got any other notions about termination? You want to make it for as many years as they've been married to each other or some crazy thing like that?
I think his reason for divorce in the first place was silly.
Okay, because I made a silly one. Does that matter to you?
Yes, it does, because the fact that I'm married to somebody who is illiterate or not as educated as I am, well, they should have had an agreement in the first place that he was going to help to educate her, and then the problem would have been solved.
Okay.
He would have educated her in the first place.
I'll change the facts.
All right.
Suppose that the husband, Dennis, finds out that his wife now is committing adultery with five other guys. Now you feel differently about
yes.
Is that right?
No.
You don't. You do. I wondered whether or not you were making a decision on the basis of comparative rectitude. That's one of my best words. Fault. You know, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy? She's a bad person and therefore let her starve. He's a bad guy, she's a good person, therefore make him pay and let her have more money. Do you want to do it on the basis of fault? Or do you want to do it on the basis of need? Needability?
Some sort of basis of economic chance. I mean, you aren't sure he's going to be a good dentist either. And we don't know if she's really going to get that job, but at least she gave him the chance to be a good or a bad dentist. He gets some decision where she gets at least that opportunity. Besides going back to her father.
Fault has nothing to do with it.
Well, she does all those things. She's just as bad as he was.
Good person, bad person, though, doesn't have anything to do with it.
It's a question of having invested money in X stock or bonds.
Right.
I mean, he's not literally a stock or a bond, but you've invested money in him and his career, and the wife was going to earn or not earn, depending on how wise her investment was, and something that's come along that's derailed her investment, and he's the derailing factor, and therefore we ought to give her the honest return on her investment. Is that what you're suggesting? Yes, ma'am.
I would go along with her to the extent that I think he should pay so she had the chance to better her education, either in nurse's training or whatever, and that would, I imagine, require a certain number of years.
Until graduation?
Well,
until she's had a chance to graduate.
Until she had a chance, let's say.
Would you feel that if the court ordered that the husband pay her, let's say, $800 a month, until she's had enough time so that she could graduate from some skill or vocation or profession that she chose, teaching, dentistry, real estate development, whatever it is, until she is adequately trained, has enough time to do that. Now suppose that that's going to be a 4-year process, let's just say that. And that at the end of the second year, she wins the Irish sweepstakes. Or an uncle dies and leaves her a lot of money, either way you like. And now suddenly she has adequate funds to pay for her own education. Should he, the former husband, be released from the obligation to pay further?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not punishing him.
Yeah, that would be all right.
Not punishing him. Were you, when you decided on the $800 a month, dividing an asset which they had earned, even though it didn't have present value, even though it didn't have present divisible form, were you dividing that? You know, you've invested in this bond, which isn't going to come due for a couple of years yet, and I'm not going to give you some of it. I'm going to give you some of it. What you do with it is up to you. Or were you making provision for her maintenance so that if circumstances changed, that it wasn't just dividing property? Do you understand the distinction that I'm getting at? What were you doing? Were you providing maintenance, or were you dividing property when you decided on that $800 a month?
We were providing rehabilitation, to throw another word into the opera.
Rehabilitation, I suppose, would come closer to maintenance payments. If she happened to get rehabilitated by the Irish sweepstakes, you'd be willing to lay them off. Would it make a difference to you if instead of a dental degree and practice, they had acquired a $50,000 house? It's very hard to divide a house in the middle. You can't, of course, sell it and divide the property. But let's say that one of the spots, and that's all that they have so far, just the house. You know, they've been so busy paying for the house, they haven't got a bank account yet. They've been eating it up from month to month. And so the house is the thing. It's $50,000 worth of house on the market. One of them wants to live in it. And you, as the judge, decide that, it wouldn't be fair, since they both earned the money that's bought the house. It wouldn't be fair to give all the house to one of the spouse and none of it to the other spouse. And so you say, well, one of you wants to live in it, I'll give the house to that spouse. But I'll order the spouse who gets the house to pay $25,000 to the spouse that doesn't get the house.
It sounds like that was...
And the house owner says, I don't have $25,000. And the judge says, well, that's all right. I don't expect you to have $25,000 in cash, but I do think that you could pay $1,000 a month for 25 months. Cape. Same question. After the first 10 payments, $10,000 worth paid now, 15 to go, the non-house owner hits the jackpot on the Irish sweepstakes and gets a lot of money. And the house owner says, well, in that case, I don't want to pay the other $15,000. He or she now has more money than I do. Do you let them up? Or do you make them pay the rest of it?
That debt is a debt.
A debt is a debt.
Pay the rest.
Pay the rest. But it's different when you ordered $800 a month to the wife who put the husband through dental school. You don't think that's different. You think the debt is a debt.
I don't think that's
change the facts a little bit again. Suppose that the husband's been through dental school, he's now got 2 years, the business is doing all right, the wife wants to get training as a real estate developer, and she wants to finish in accounting business administration. She's been given $800 a month, and because of inflation and other things, the school's tuition changes and the cost of books goes up, and she now can't do it for $800 a month. She needs $1,000 a month. And she comes back to the judge and says, Judge, I want $1,000 a month. And the husband says, a debt is a debt, a division is a division. You got yours and I got mine, it was $800 a month, and don't bring your grief to me. The next thing I know, you'll be out going out and catching flu and coming back and say you want more money, or breaking your back and being disabled, and then you want more money. And I'm through with you. You know, we dissolved our relationship. You took yours and I took mine. You going to give her more money? One of the major differentiating characteristics between a division of property and maintenance is the fact that property is a deal. It's finished. It's conclusive. That's all. It's over. No modification possible. Whereas maintenance can be modified, up or down. If the wife hits the Irish sweepstakes, she doesn't need as much. The husband may be released from some of the obligation to pay maintenance. If she breaks her back and can't work, she may get more because her need is increased. And the ratio between husband and wife changes. Now, as a practical matter, do you prefer maintenance as a way of handling interspousal relationships, the economic relationships at the time of divorce, or do you favor division of property?
Can't you have both?
You can have both. Would you like a package of both?
Yeah.
Here's the dentist out there, and we give her $500 a month as a division of property, and we give her $300 a month as maintenance. Yes, sir?
Excuse me, we have a couple of principles that are directing our thoughts here. One is that we're trying to allow people to be maintained without relying on the public tax roll. That
all right.
Is keeping whatever wealth is involved amongst the parties to maintain them so that the rest of the taxpayers don't have to do it. And secondly, you got one principle of a family unit is that generally all the members of a family unit live at approximately the same standard of living. And when that family unit is suddenly broken, we just like to see some members of the family suddenly dropped to a lower standard of living than other members are not. So that we're trying to find a way where that all the members of the family unit can maintain at least a roughly equivalent standard of living. And both of those principles can be achieved partly through maintenance, partly through division of property, I think.
So we might want to be looking for a package, a mixture.
One thing that occurred to me is that if one of the spouses, say the non-income earning spouse, wins the Irish sweepstakes, might that person not have to turn some of that over to the other, whose income might now be much less? That is it.
Suppose that he loses his job.
Right.
That his good tooth pulling hand suddenly develops some sort of difficulty, and he's in trouble because he can't pull molars anymore.
and she has won the Irish sweepstakes. Shall we follow the day of we principle and make her turn over part of the Irish sweepstakes winning to him? Or against or says, what sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Now notice that it becomes very important at this point whether or not we have, in the original dissolution of the family, decided that we were dividing property or we were providing maintenance, the latter being subject to revision, modification, upwards or downwards, the former not.
Why didn't you try to get them reconciled so you don't have to go through all that?
Perhaps, although reconciliation itself may not occur, perhaps we could do better by a conciliation process or a mediation process by which we would have the spouses decide and determine for themselves what the property split ought to be and what the alimony factor ought to be, reduce that to a contract, and then have the court rubber stamp it. Anybody see any problems with that process?
Yes.
You want to verbalize them a little bit?
Half the time in divorces, people can't, if there's a lot of money involved, they can't decide amongst themselves. You have to go to the court to decide because they just argue over. Most divorces don't have property settlements that involve a lot of money because they can't agree on how to split it up.
Would you want them to?
If they could work it out.
If they could work it out. If you had one strong person in the divorce...
You'd have to have a mediating party there. But
you'd have to have a mediating party. Now, here I guess we're going to have to define terms. When I say mediation, I mean somebody who tries to get the two people together and let them work out their problem. When I say conciliation, technical definition, I will now mean somebody who suggests how it ought to be done, someone who tries to influence the decision. Are you in favor of mediation or conciliation?
Conciliation.
So a supervisor, a governor out there to help with the process. And then do you think that maybe it would also be a good idea that it go home to Papa, that is the judge, where the state could look at it and see whether or not one party is selling out too cheap? There have been thousands and thousands of instances in which a man and a woman with a couple children struggling to get along on a modest income have finally said to each other, you know, we're out of our minds. We're not making enough money for four people to live on, two adults and two children. Why should we struggle further? One of us, the employed one, whichever that is, keep the income and live on it. The other one, take the children and go down to the nearest office of the Department of Social Security or Public Assistance and apply for aid for families with dependent children. The custodial parent and the children will have more money than they've got right now from the state, and the non-custodial parent will have all the money that's being earned, and they'll all be better off, of course, except the state. But then after all, what are taxpayers for? Now, I'm giving you a very common kind of illustration. Does that do something to your selfish, greedy natures? You want to resist that? I'm sorry?
Lots of debt is going on.
Oh, sure. And if we make it easy, a lot more will. Now, maybe we ought to rejoice that all of those people will be living more comfortably. But that doesn't seem to be the common impression of most taxpayers who tend to approach this problem with words like rip-off and fraud. Do we have to go to court so the prosecuting attorney's office or somebody from the attorney general's office or somebody can come in and review the bidding, the contract, social control? Marriage has frequently been defined as a three-party contract.
What?
Three-party contract. Man, woman, state. And the state, the silent party, gets exercised when you decide to shift the economic burdens in such a way that the state's going to pick up more of the
obligation.
Vernon, may I ask, this couple now, of course, is legally divorced, are they not?
The process of becoming legally divorced.
In the process of it?
Well,
they're
as
not
part
here.
Of that process, this economic determination is going to be made. Then when it's made, bingo, we're going to change the status from married to divorced. That's right, married to single.
Oh, I was thinking they were really legally divorced and that the problem of remarriage might come in, but that's irrelevant, I guess, in this
case. Oh, indeed it is not. In many, many instances. Remarriage, very common. And then you've got the problem of here's the man or the woman who's been ordered to pay some percentage of his or her income for the first family, and now there's a second family, maybe complete with children. And he says, well, I could pay this amount to my former family until I remarried, but now I can't because I got more people over here to pay. Is that a basis for reducing his obligations to his first family? Or does the second family take a encumbered provider and has to be willing to accept a lower standard of living?
No, the second wife has to go out and get a job.
Second wife has to go out and get a job. Yeah. Well, these are illustrative of the kinds of problems that we have to wrestle with in the problem that we're addressing this morning. Oh, I've chosen to illustrate the situation with a low income, perhaps not very able, that doesn't necessarily follow, but perhaps not very able group where public assistance is a real necessity. You can go to the other extreme. We have lots of interesting cases in which several million dollars may be changing hands, and it's tied up into corporations and to major businesses and to wheat farms and dental supplies and you know, think of an ordinary, almost as much many dollars worth of equipment as a farmer who's going to grow grain has to have. Are you going to take away from him all of his equipment and give it to the wife? Or are you going to leave him in practice and give her alimony, a lesser income? Those are all rather fascinating and interesting questions. One which has been of particular interest in the last couple of years, and again we have help from the United States Supreme Court, a man has been working for X Corporation for 28 years. Two more years and he retires. He retires on a good monthly pension. His wife has been home. She's reared the children. They are all now adults and self-supporting. She has not developed a career of her own. She has not worked for money outside the household. She's worked in the household very hard, maybe harder than he has. But she doesn't have a monthly paycheck coming in. She doesn't have a pension. Comes now the divorce. Shall we give her half of his pension? Is that property? Suppose that you order him to pay her the cash value of half of his pension right now, and he dies before he retires. A colleague of mine wrote a fine textbook. It's going to be used, I'm sure, in many schools for a long time. He's going to have quite a few royalties. He spent so much time at school writing the textbook, he didn't see enough of his wife. Their marriage collapsed. In the dissolution process, the court ordered him to provide her half of the royalties on the book as they are realized over successive years. He didn't have much money in the bank. They didn't have much property built up, but he had a good royalty. Do you like that decision?
That's really community property.
In the state of Washington and seven other states, it would be community property. In the other states of the 50, it would be his. You know, common law states. In those, you're absolutely right about Washington, Gill, although in Washington and some of the community property states, the court may use its discretion at the time of dissolution as to how much to give one spouse or the other. In Washington, it would be regarded as community property commonly owned by both the husband and wife. Most states, it would not be. Would you give the writer of the book the full royalty as his or her property?
Or would you say that's to be divided, even though it's to be realized in the future? Is that different than the earnings of the dentist?
No.
Not. Would you give it to the non-writing spouse in a cash amount, or would you give it in periodic payments for a number of years? Periodic payments. Would you give it in periodic payments, like 50% of all the royalties that are received, or would you give it in periodic payments, like $1,000 a month for the next 50 months? You know, if you give it in periodic periods payments of the amount that's received, royalties might be very small monthly. Would you rather cascade it down into bigger payments for a short time so that the spouse can obtain some education, training, make a transition to self-support early on?
Couldn't they agree on that like they would
can
piece
agree.
Of property?
Can agree on it if they want to. We still have the question of whether or not we ought to run it through court to let the state look at it to see whether or not somebody's getting the short end of the deal. But many instances now, if you were one of my students in class, I would be arguing strongly now for the mediated contract division. I personally think that's an awfully good way to go. You've raised now the question, and it's the last one I'd like to discuss with you this morning, as we're coming close to the end of the time that we have to spend with this. You can say the court ought to settle the property, the economic questions. Come in and tell the judge all about it. Both sides make their arguments. I hope that paints a picture for you. Both the wife and the husband hire attorneys, and they come in and they argue. I am representing one of the nicest women that ever walked on the face of the earth. She's worked hard all these years at home taking care of him, and she's a good gal and he's a bad guy. He's got all the money and she's got none. He's healthy as a bull and her health is not very good. He's practically immune to being hurt. She's a very sensitive, delicate woman. Your Honor, we want at least 2/3 of his earnings. And of course, he makes the same sort of statement on the other side. Unpleasant kind of litigation. And yet you can't ask a judge to make a determination without hearing as much about the situation as she or he can know. It's not fair to ask judges to judge without giving them the facts. And the facts, of course, aren't reliable unless they're cross-examined. People do lie, you know, especially when it's to their advantage to do so. Well, I'm trying to paint a quick picture for you of litigation to decide this. Second option, they contract and do it. He is strong as a bull. He is dominant. She has always been submissive. She has always let him take advantage of her. Now that they're down to the question of dividing property, he's not forgotten how to do it. And he takes advantage of her in the contract. Or she takes advantage of him. Or they sit there and look at each other and say, I guess we're just not up to this. Or they do a good job of it. Or do you like contract as a possibility? Or a third possibility, would you rather set up just a mechanical, arbitrary, 50-50, 25-75, something else, and just pull the lever and bing, out it comes. We don't care whether you've got the hoop and cough or whether you're healthy. We don't care whether you're young or old. We don't care whether you're good or bad. We don't care whether you're educated or uneducated. All we know is that you got $200,000 and we pulled the lever and out came $100,000 each. And that's it. Without any consideration of the specific arrangements in that separate transaction. Do you want justice to be equated to the needs of the particular persons and the particular situations, or good enough for all? I have put on the board something that we are doing in the state of Washington. A few other states are doing it too. This happens to deal with child support. We know a lot about how much money we spend to support our children. The Bureau of Labor Statistics keeps very careful track about how much the average American income goes for the support of children. One child, two child, three child, four child. Now, of course, you all know that infants eat less than 18-year-old boys who are out working on the farm. And it costs a little bit more to support an older child than it does a young child, you know, like 400 times more or something of that sort. So all children are not equal in cost. But if you average everything up, the average child, the average family, you come up with some numbers. Now to begin with, as I may already have mentioned, at the time of dissolution of a family relationship, there is a decrease of about 12 to 15% in the standard of living. So we'll take the average amount that a child gets and reduce that. Just arbitrarily, we're going to say the child is a member of the family who's got to take a cut in living standard along with the father and the mother. We'll just say that, just for purposes of trying to get to our mechanical process here. Then we will take the average of the United States, and we will look at how much of a family's income goes to support a child. And we will learn that when we've done that, that if there is one child in the family, that 24% of the income of the family will go for the support of that child. If there are two children in the family, 35% of their income. Three children, 42% of their income will go directly to the support of the child. Four children, 48% of the family's income will go to the support of those four children. That's a reduction of 12% from what the married family would spend, you understand. The married family is spending 24 plus 12, 36% of the married family's income. We're cutting the kid's living right away. And then the proposal is that we take the number of dollars that the non-custodial spouse, the spouse who doesn't have custody, let's just say, as is true in most cases, that custody of the children is given to the mother, and the father is earning a monthly income net after he's paid his taxes, after he's paid his labor dues, Social Security, so forth. He's earning a net of $300 a month, $3,600 a year.
That assumes the custodial spouse is not working.
It assumes that the custodial spouse may or may not be working. It assumes nothing here to pay the support of the custodial spouse, the wife in our illustration. If she's going to have something to eat, she's going to have to find it someplace else, either by working or from her parents or Social Security or something. The amount of money I'm talking about now is a proposal for child support only. Now, you know as well as I do that many mothers who receive a payment for child support don't have other income, and that they eat half of the groceries that they buy with the child support money. That happens, of course, all the time. Inevitably, it does. $300 a month. Net income for the non-custodial spouse, 72 of that we will order, if there's one child, to be paid to the wife for the child support. If there are two children, 105, three children, 135, four children, $144. 144, 48%, which is 12% less than he would be spending if he were home. Remember that, if the family was still intact, that's 12% less than he would be spending out of his $300 to support his children. $500, you can read the numbers, $1,000. Suppose that he's earning $1,500 a month. He's got an annual income of $18,000. Certainly not a very unusually high income today. How much should the non-custodial husband pay? If you used that flow chart, you would order him to pay one child $340, two children $525, three children $630, four children $720 to be paid by the husband to the custodial spouse for the support of the children. Now, we could very easily devise other charts that would indicate how much of the earnings of one spouse went for the support of the other spouse. whether one was employed or both were employed, and we could set up another draft like this, which would give us a mechanical basis. Do you like, now that you've seen it, do you like the mechanical?
How can that apply to all kinds of people, though? They've been living on different standards.
Some people spend all their money on boats and eat practically nothing. Some people eat everything and spend nothing on boats. Some kids live at a high standard of living, some live at a low standard. It's an average, that's right. You know, this is all the United States sort of mishmashed together into an average figure.
Does this change then as his income changes?
Changes as his income changes. If he gets a promotion that goes to 500, the kids get less. If he gets a cut in his pay and earns less, the kids get less. Does that bother you?
Percentage-wise.
Percentage-wise. And then it comes out then, of course, in actual dollars when it's translated. Are you thinking of the disincentive factor?
No, I'm thinking of, I work with a lot of mothers who have gone through divorce through the daycare. And I see how they're struggling, and the father's supposed to pay the daycare. We're having a hard time collecting from a lot of them.
Yeah, you would believe if you're working with it, but the rest of you who may not be working with this problem would probably be astounded to know the low rate of payments in support orders. Very low. It gets much better if the parties have agreed, contracted. You know, if it's their deal, there's much greater likelihood that it will be paid. It may be a little lower, but at least you get it. No point in having $1,000 a month ordered and not be able to collect it. We export a lot of fathers to Australia and to other places. Lawyers have kind of a rule of thumb that says take more than one third of a spouse's net monthly income and you got a runaway. Now that's like all other rules. That's a kind of an average rule of thumb. Now that may be totally inadequate to support the children and the other spouse. One third, I'm not talking about very much. You hit one third right there with two kids. But you take more than one third and the disincentive factor becomes so strong that you could almost bet that you've got a border hopper coming up. Men will dump good jobs and run. You know, if I only get to keep 600, why should I earn 1,000? I'll work half-time or part-time or some other job where I don't have to work so much and earn less, and I'll do it in another state. I'll go to Minnesota or some other uncivilized part of the world. They'll never catch up with me, and I'll earn my money there and spend it for myself. Well, what do you like? Discretion of the court after argument?
I just don't like men who shed that kind of responsibility.
I don't like sin either, Lowe, but we live with it, huh? Well, those are the three factors, and the only three we've come up with so far. Order of the court, contract of the parties, mechanical jurisprudence. And that's kind of the way it is.
The advantage of mechanical, one advantage is you get away from the adversary adding more hate than heat to the relationship.
Yep.
Which may involve both the kids as well as the parents.
Yep.
The disadvantage is the runaway factor that you say.
Yep.
So you got to sort of toss those balls up in the air and decide where you're coming down.
Yep. And of course we're going to call in our sociologists at this point. We're going to do a lot more measuring than we've done in the past to see which one of these factors really produces the most bucks over where the kids are going for meals and shelter and so forth.
How about the psychologist on which is the most trauma?
Very fascinating kind of thing to study. In separation, and I say separation at this point rather than divorce, because the damage comes at the point of separation, when the family realizes that it's broken now. Whether they divorce or not is almost immaterial in terms of the trauma that you're talking about. We have conducted a study in the school where I teach, in which we took 1,000 families and tracked them rather carefully, and we found that at the point of separation, in 80-some percent, 82 if I remember correctly, of the cases, there was at least one spouse who at that time was so severely damaged psychologically that he or she was incompetent of carrying on normal daily activities, you know, going to work, taking care of the kids, and so forth. The amount of damage that is accomplished by that time, I'd like to say it that way, it isn't just that fact in itself which does it. It's an accretion, an accumulation over a year or two or three or four of increasing stress in the family and arguments and fights and so forth, so that when the break comes, you find this extraordinarily high number of people who are seriously damaged. And we ought to be able to devise some means of working with those numbers. I'm keeping you over time, and it's time to quit. For those of you who are interested in this subject and would like to talk some more about it, and incidentally, I apologize for having talked as much as I have this morning rather than letting you talk. I much prefer a discourse than a lecture. But if you're interested in discussing this problem, this is what I would like to discuss tomorrow evening at 6:30. Maybe we are quite wrong in putting all of this in the structure of a courtroom. Maybe we ought to be out of this. Maybe there ought to be some other way of handling these problems. Maybe there ought to be some way of handling the psychological stress that we've not done very well. It's a very important factor along with the economics. However, in saying that, it's, I trust, perfectly obvious that we must protect a variety of interests here. You've got to protect the kids. Certainly the state is entitled to some protection. Don't know, maybe we've overprotected the state, but it's entitled to some protection. Certainly the two people have to be protected. And maybe we ought to be looking at who's the damaged and who's the weak. Historically, we have, of course, looked at who's the sinner and punished them. Now we've gotten away from the concept of fault. I am the draftsman of the divorce law of this state, and I am proud of the fact that in our divorce act, fault is an almost irrelevant factor. The question is who needs and who has the ability, and that's to be measured by some factors which we can yet struggle with. Well, we've not finished the subject, but we've finished our time, so we're going to quit, and if any of you have questions, I'd be delighted to respond if I can individually, or if you want to talk about it some more, why we get another shot tomorrow.
If I haven't gotten off Martin's Ridge by 6:30 tomorrow, I'd be late.
Sure. Thank you very much.